My name is Ben Burrell, and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Welcome to Season 6. Hope all is good. The last time these episodes were going out, we were in the thick of lockdown here in the United Kingdom. I hope things are slightly improving where you are in terms of the weird year we've all just had. Things are slowly starting to get back to normal here in the United Kingdom, and I hope things are the same where you are right now. If you missed the little announcement, then this is a special season of the podcast. Season 6 is looking at Blonde on Blonde and Blonde on Blonde only. The entire season is dedicated to that incredible record. I can't wait to go through this album with you. We're going to do 2 songs per episode and have a look at everything from the artwork to the studio, to the players, to the aftermath, everything. This first episode looks at the first 2 tracks and also the album's difficult early recording process, which was a tough time, I think, for Dylan. Before we get to that, if you missed another announcement, then in the slightly weird year we've all just had, I set up a brand new show called Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra. It's on Patreon, and the idea is that I bring you a show every couple of weeks on Dylan, not just his albums, but similar shows to this, so looking at his songs, looking at his career. There's interviews up there as well. Come and join us. There's a great little community over there. You can find the link to the Patreon page in this episode's description. Also, not only do you get extra content, but obviously you're supporting the show as well, keeping the show going, keeping it financially viable, because there's quite a few outlays when you put out a show like this. So come and join us over there for the content and to support the show. And also, as I say, there's a nice little community developing over there. Not only do you get that extra content, but you also get a little shout out on this show as well. So let's say hello to some people. Hi to Bradley Howe. Hello, Alan Zebka. Hi to David Eldridge. Hello, Sam. Hi, Reed. Hello, Dan. Hi, DD. Hi, Stuart. Hi, Mick. Hi, Howard Davidson. Hello to Chris. Hello to Michael Stewart. Hello to Erin. Hi to Peter. Hi to Christopher. Hello to Philip. Hello, William Joyce. Hello to Tractor Man. Hi to Andrew. Hi to Jamie. And hi to Boyd Hythe as well. As I say, fancy joining us over on the Patreon feed for Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra and to support the show and get some extra shows. You can find the link in this episode's description. Let's not waste any more time, shall we? Let's get straight to the first episode on the incredible Blonde on Blonde. You say you love me and you're thinking of me, but you know you could be wrong. You say you told me that you wanna hold me, but you know you're not that strong. Dylan's output at this time is exhausting. Even reading about it is exhausting. After 4 masterpieces in 3 years in the form of The Times They Are Changing, The Freewheeling, Highway 61 Revisited and Bringing It All Back Home, all of which would affect music so deeply that now, over 50 years later, we are still feeling the tremors of, Dylan wouldn't retreat. He wouldn't self-destruct, yet, anyway. He wouldn't lose himself to his own hype. He would, in fact, push himself even further. After everything, the protest songs, the shouts of Judas, the box office of Like a Rolling Stone, the relationships and the press conferences, the tours and the drugs and the exhaustion, he comes back with a double album that creates a whole new sound and once again changes music forever. It's the sort of album that should come with years of tinkering and planning and precision, not off the back of a run of classics, and an exhausting run at that. This journey that began with the humble beginnings of 1962's Bob Dylan would end with an odyssey of music. Dylan would give one last blast of genius to finish this exhausting, unmatched period of creativity. It's all on this LP, from better than the Beatles pop like I Want You, to the type of torch song that Sinatra would have killed for in the form of Just Like a Woman, to poetry that would dazzle Keats in the form of Visions of Johanna. Bob created a sprawling magnum opus that would end up pushing him right to the brink. In fact, it's a period that would eventually kill the Bob Dylan we all knew. Sit back and enjoy the ride before the wheels come off, because this is Blonde on Blonde.
Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would. They'll stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone.
It starts with what Dylan has called a bell tower announcement of what was to come. And he's right. Rainy Day Women number 12 and 35 is like someone opening the door to a secret burlesque club.
Well, they'll stone you when you're walking on the street.
By the time the final bar's finished, you're already in. The door behind you is closed and the party has begun. There's no turning back from here. You're in the world of Blonde on Blonde. It's a shimmery golden world that feels burnt round the edges. It's all in soft focus. New York looms somewhere in the background with a strange somber tone hanging over much of it. It's a late night record. That wild Mercury sound almost drips out of the speakers when you play it. It's like nothing before and nothing since. It's introduced to us by that drunk, woozy brass band as they roll into the tune, sounding like a Salvation Army band that has been defied by the devil. Those shouts in the background make for a raucous atmosphere as Dylan presents us with the mania of the last 3 years of his life. You can almost hear his fame in the background of those shouts, the strange world he's been introduced to and he's been living. You can hear the foggy exhaustion of the tours and the drugs in the brass band's languid rasp, and you can hear his obnoxious shrugs at his naysayers in that half-laugh delivery. It, in many ways, is the perfect opener. Sure, it's not the perfect song, but after all the intensity and pressure of those last two electric-leaning albums, here, this song is vital. It feels like Dylan is cutting loose and firing shots and rising above it all at once. Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good, he utters, sounding, to use a British word, knackered. Like we've heard on Highway 61, his performance has a manic quality, and the backing of the brass band here punctuates that perfectly. It communicates his weariness. If you're wondering how they created that studio atmosphere, then it might not have been down to any studio trickery. It perhaps was chaotic. The song was done in one take. In fact, they only did one rehearsal take just before that. Things were so relaxed on the studio audio taken from the Cutting Edge bootleg box set, you can hear producer Bob Johnston ask organist and guitar player Al Cooper to turn his radio off for the take. You can also hear a suggestion on how the track should start with its now famous drum intro. This literally comes seconds before they press record, and that's not mentioning Dylan telling Charlie McCoy to slow down on the bass as well. It's fair to say this was done on the hoof.
During the take, Al, can you keep that radio off?
Hey, what do you think about
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man. Charlie with the trumpet a little bit.
No, that's too fast.
They very much just left the tape running and cut it there and then. Can I remind you, this is the opening track to one of the most revered albums of our time, and they're just making it up as they go. Bob even gives it that glib title in the audio, too.
What's the name of this, Bob?
Battle McCray.
A long-haired mule and a porcupine here.
Not only was the track done a little last minute with its session players, but a player was even called in at the 11th hour too. Wayne Doc Butler is on the trombone on the track. Charlie McCoy had put in a last-minute call at Dylan's request at around about 2 a.m, according to Al Cooper. Butler was woken up, he got up, and he put the brass straight into the boot of his car and drove to the studio. He was there 45 minutes later, quote, clean-shaven with a shirt and tie on. He rolled through the rehearsal take and the song's master take, and then he went home. That was it. In the middle of the night, he'd appeared on a classic record, and by the time he was back in bed, his career was changed forever. I hadn't even got warmed up, he remembers of a session, and Bob began, and, well, that was it. There was clearly no hanging around in these sessions, and that's a constant from Bob at this time, and pretty much ever since. That's why a lot of these songs have a spontaneity that invites repeated listens. There's imperfect bits in each recording that gives the songs a character and a depth that would be lost on repeated recordings and overdubs. In his book, Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan, Howard Soons gives us an insight into the song's recording. Apparently, late one evening, Bob asked the session players, "What do you guys do here?" Wayne Moss, the guitarist, and some others muttered something about playing golf. "That's not what I mean," he said. "What do you do here?" He was asking how they got high. Bob said he had a new song, the lyric of which included the refrain, "Everybody must get stoned." With only the offer of beer, Dylan apparently sent out for something else. A studio custodian by the name of Edgar Czar was sent out to the nearby Islands Bar for an order of leprechaun cocktails, which, by the way, is apparently a potent green-coloured concoction. He also managed to obtain marijuana. Joints were passed round and musicians got high and drunk, living out the fantasy of the song, and then they... Actually, apparently, this might not be true. Whilst Rainy Day Women sounds like a party getting out of control, session player Al Cooper denies pretty much all of this. He says the musicians were actually really professional people. None of that happened with them. Other players in the session have said they did get a little loaded, but it doesn't appear to be as bad as once thought. The tapes of the session don't sound like a crazy party on the edge, so we can assume that it wasn't quite as raucous as we once thought it was. Their performance is certainly not a living embodiment of the lyrics of the song. Either way, they did spice it up a little in the studio. Cooper says there was some instrument swapping to bring that woozy effect to the tune. His organ remained untouched and he instead took on tambourine duties. And he was the chief screamer. No, that's not his official title in the liner notes, by the way. Although it should have been. But yes, that is him going crazy in the background. He says he did it as the others were a little bit too bashful. But while the sonic atmosphere suggests a distorted carnival of decadence, is that really what the song's about? In Robert Shelton's biography of Dylan, Shelton said that he was told by Phil Spector that the inspiration for the song came when Spector and Dylan heard the Ray Charles tune Let's Go Get Stoned on a jukebox in Los Angeles. Spector said they were surprised to hear a song that free and that explicit. Although this anecdote may be questioned because the Ray Charles song was released in April 1966 after Rainy Day Women was recorded, it could be that Spector heard another song with similar lyrics. But at the song's core, it definitely feels like it is trying to be a little overt, a little shocking even, or a little wry and witty. Dylan himself has said the tune was very protest, and one of the most protestiest things I've protested against in all my protest years, which is a nice chunk of sarcasm, always my favourite Dylan mode. But I think he might be right too, he might be telling us the truth. He did say to New York radio host Bob Fass in 1986 that everyone must get stoned is like when you go against the tide. You might do different things. You might in different times find yourself in an unfortunate situation. And so to do what you believe in, sometimes some people, they take offence to that. You can look through history and find that people have taken offence to people who have come out with different viewpoints on things. In a way, this is the ultimate protest song, a song about free thinking and going against the grain when you believe it's right. And the general feeling seems to be about breaking away from others, thinking for yourself. They'll stone you for it, but you have to go through that. Which is the very essence of a great protest song. How many times have we seen Dylan do the unexpected? How many times have I listed these moments again and again on this podcast? The Christian era, the Frank covers. I could go on yet again. But it's true, he's the master of doing his own thing. So this song, masquerading as a throwaway bit, feels like it might be Dylan being his most honest and open. For me, getting stoned is both people taking offence to your differing opinion, akin to getting stoned as a form of capital punishment, but also not caring about it. Like when you get stoned on narcotics, it's about accepting that people might not agree with you and you shouldn't really worry about that. Everyone must get stoned. It's possible Dylan is also talking about his experience with the folk scene here. Although, like I've said before, we could apply that to pretty much any Dylan tune around this time or since. I feel like it might be more general than that. Dylan had to answer so many questions and was under so much scrutiny in these years. It's no surprise he cut a song like this, a song about letting go and coming to terms with everything. Despite the song's odd title, which many have linked to the Book of Proverbs, the quote being, "A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike," which feels like a really good Dylan joke, the tune was a big success. It was released as a single on the 22nd of March 1966 and reached number 2 on the Billboard Singles Chart and number 7 in the UK, matching Like a Rolling Stones chart success. While Rainy Day Women is a fairly unique song in Dylan's back catalogue, the album's second track, Pledging My Time, is back to much safer territory. It starts like 10 of the 14 songs on the LP with the almost immediate introduction of the harmonica. From here, Dylan brings us a Chicago blues song that recalls Elmore James and Robert Johnson and the Mississippi Shakes, the latter of which's song, Sitting on Top of the World, might have been the inspiration, musically, for Dylan.
Was all the summer and all the fall. find my little all in all. But now she's gone, I don't worry. I'm sitting on top of the world.
As for the Dylan cuts, it came pretty easily in the studio. Bob had just got back from a brief promo and live tour where he was already playing songs like Visions of Johanna and Fourth Time Around in his set. After not having too many songs ready to go in the previous sessions, he returned from that tour with the likes of Absolutely Sweet Marie and Just Like a Woman and Pledging My Time. The day they cut Pledging My Time in the studio, they focused mainly on Just Like a Woman. In fact, there's only two full takes of this song, and one of those is a rehearsal. In the studio, it went like this. Take one, which broke down. Take two was the rehearsal take as they refined the song. Take three was a forced start. And then take four was the version you hear on the record. The song itself is really the first indication of the album's famous sound. That thin guitar sounds great. Robbie Robertson and Charlie McCoy and Joe South and Wayne Moss are all on the Loggers guitar players for this session, while Kenneth Buttery is on drums panned into the right ear, which is a common occurrence on the LP. The song's headliner, though, is the harmonica. It does that great blues thing of being played between the words and the lines. It's performed by Dylan, who at one point delivers an impossibly long note before culminating in a solo at the end, which sounds like it's a Hammond organ growling rather than the usual rasp of the harmonica. As always with Dylan, especially in this era, the song's words are intriguing. Like a lot of Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61, there's a healthy dose of surrealism, but also pain and confusion. I've got a poison headache, Dylan tells us at one point, which is a very mid-60s Dylan line. I often like to remind anyone who listens to these podcasts that my explanations of these songs' meanings is only my opinion. It's never dressed up as fact, and it's ever-shifting too. You can change your opinions on songs. Here, though, I feel like Dylan, especially at this time and possibly throughout his career, likes to write in themes. Over the last 20 years of his work, we've had themes to do with the end of the world and mortality. That's taken an even bigger focus in his work. With Blood on the Tracks through to Desire and Street Legal, we heard him focusing on the breakdown of relationships with varying intensity. A year before Blonde on Blonde, we had that rush of disdain pumping through many songs' veins as Dylan wrote tunes like Positively 4th Street and Ballad of a Thin Man and Like a Rolling Stone and Queen Jane. Here, though, there seems to be more of a focus on love. I don't think that Blonde on Blonde is a love album, but it does seem to be present in these stories of New York lofts and sad-eyed ladies. Piecing together bits, it would appear songs like Fourth Time Around and One of Us Must Know and Just Like a Woman and Temporary Like Achilles are all written around the same time as Pledging My Time. It seems that Dylan would have love on his mind a lot in this period. But is your heart made out of stone, or is it lime, or is it just solid rock? He sings on Temporary Like Achilles. Fourth Time Around, forgetting the John Lennon diss for a second, appears to be a warring couple, whilst One of Us Must Know contains a raft of wonderful lines like, when you whispered in my ear and asked me if I was leaving with you or her, I didn't realise just what I did here. Pledging My Time feels like it's along these lines too, except it's not a tale of just love. It's a tale of love and dependency and desire and, at times, darkness. It's not only sonically inspired by the blues, but the lyrics have all these genres' hallmarks too. An opener like, well, Early in the Morning, is how a thousand blues songs have started. But the lines that follow that one could be about anything. For a long time, I felt the song was about depending on drugs, but more and more, it feels like a kind of dependent love, or a love to get you through. In every verse, our narrator is looking for this person to be there for him. He asks for their help with that poison headache. He seeks comfort when the hobo steals his love away. He even flat out asks her to come with him, a sort of no strings attached invitation in the third verse as Dylan sings, "Won't you come with me, baby? I'll take you where you want to go. And if it don't work out, you'll be the first to know. I'm pledging my time to you, hoping you'll come through too." This is one of a couple of jokey lines, the other being, "Everybody's gone but me and you, and I can't be the last to leave." According to writer Clinton Halen, there was a line that Dylan wrote along the lines of, "Pledging my time, if nothing comes out of this, you'll soon know." That appeared on one of Bob's transcripts from this era under the title of Song Ideas. As a side note to this, I love that Bob has written out some song ideas on a piece of paper. Where did he keep these? Was there a filing cabinet full of these? How was his admin worked out? Did someone do it for him? A lot of questions, perhaps for a future podcast. It feels like the song, though, is a narrator looking for love, or at least a type of comfort, looking for a dependent. He is, in many ways, a little boy lost. The whole song paints our narrator as a bit of a mess. Lines about rooms he can hardly breathe in and headaches make his world feel close and boxed in, dry and somber. Of course, this is not the last time we're in a place like this on Blonde on Blonde. He seems dependent on this person he keeps asking about. He seems dependent on them coming through for him, especially in the song's dark ending of, "Well, they sent for an ambulance and one was sent. Somebody got lucky, but it was by accident. Now I'm pledging my time to you, hoping you'll come through too." Our narrator is wrapped up in something shady, something terrible has happened, but he appears to have got lucky and is away from that situation now. Once again, he's relying on this person to help him out. I can't really call them a great lover, as our narrator only ever seems to be giving them time, pledging time to them, hoping they'll do the same for him. Perhaps it's more than that, beyond just love, say. Perhaps this is more about comfort. The lines of "Pledging My Time" are classic Dylan, like we've seen from him 100 times. In these lines, it feels like we get a glimpse of the story, but never the full picture. Jax Levy, a collaborator on the Desire album, once said that Dylan isn't good at telling a story from start to finish, which is kind of true, but also kind of great. How many mysteries have you read or watched that peter out after the big reveal happens? The mystery is always the most intriguing bit, and Dylan has built a career on it, and this song is the perfect example of that. I feel like this might be partly intended and partly a coincidence of how he's wrote some of these songs in a stream of consciousness type ramble, but partly because we also overanalyze his work, and sometimes he's just looking for a rhyme or a line that fits. You can see that as these songs are changed and refined, something we'll look at in the next episode. On this song, though, the ending is wonderful. That lack of context makes it a chilling, confusing ending. It's almost unnerving because you don't see it coming, and the use of the word "lucky" against the backdrop of an ambulance has a Machiavellian quality about it.
Well, they sent for the ambulance, then one was sent. Somebody got lucky, but it was an accident. I'm pledging my time to you, hoping you'll come through too.
As we've seen, the song came pretty easily in the studio. Blonde on Blonde itself did not. It began life with a whimper. On the 5th of October 1965, Dylan took his live band, The Hawks, who would of course later become the band, into Studio A of Columbia Records in New York City. At the time, New York, and that studio specifically, was Dylan's creative stomping ground. They'd assembled that day to record a follow-up to Positively 4th Street. That had been cut in the third Highway 61 session back in July. 4th Street was a big single for Dylan, and the record company wanted more. They did eventually get their single, but not in this session. "Can You Please Crawl Out of Your Window" wouldn't be captured until the 30th of November. Back at this first Blonde on Blonde session, if we can call it that, in fact it wasn't really a Blonde on Blonde session at all. As we saw earlier, there was a lack of finished songs, so much so that this session concentrated on songs that didn't even make it onto the LP. They tried tunes like "Jet Piler" and "I Wanna Be Your Lover" and an early attempt at "Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window." There was also an instrumental titled "Number One" and another song titled "Medicine Sunday."
On a midnight train, pulling out down the track, you're standing there watching with your hands folded behind your back.
While they had clearly covered a bit of ground in the studio, they must have left that day feeling like they hadn't really captured much at all. None of these songs were really in contention for the next LP. Between the first session in October and the November sessions where they got "Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window," Dylan and the Hawks would go on the road. And while things weren't that great in the studio, they weren't great live either. The concert booing from the folk diehards in the audience was still happening. Guitarist Robbie Robertson recalled, "When people boo you night after night, it can affect your confidence. Anyone else would have said, well, the audience isn't liking this, let's change what we're doing. But, you know, we didn't budge." Robertson paints a defiant picture there, but the booing did take its toll on some other members of the band. Drummer Levon Helm would leave the band after the tour's final gig in Washington, D.C., 2 days before the November session. "I was smiling on the outside, but I was crying on the inside," he said. Bobby Gregg, a drummer that Dylan knew well, was subbed into that session. Returning producer from Highway 61, Bob Johnston, was in the control room, and he brought some non-Hawks musicians in as well. He selected players who had joined Dylan on the Bringing It All Back Home and Highway 61 LPs, most notably organist Al Cooper, pianist Paul Griffin, and guitarist Bruce Langhorne. Johnston also brought in Joe South, a Nashville musician, something that would foreshadow the album's future. They started the session at 2:30 p.m, attempting a new song called Freeze Out. Dylan had apparently written it 33 weeks prior on the 9th of November during the Great Northeast Blackout that knocked out electricity in 8 states. The song would be retitled Visions of Johanna.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be quiet?
But on that day, the song didn't come. Despite 14 attempts and some completed versions, well, 4 completed versions, never a good ratio, Dylan wasn't satisfied. Take 7 of the song was a complete take, running over 9 minutes at a slower tempo, but still, Dylan wasn't happy. He finished it by saying, "That's not right. That's not right at all," on the microphone. The song's 14th and final take was another complete one, but it still wasn't what Dylan wanted. It was abandoned for the night. Dylan left the studio and went into a cold New York evening, frustrated. Drummer Gregg appears to bear the brunt of the criticism for the song's failure in the studio that day. Something that shows in the fact that Dylan would perform the song acoustically during live shows around this time, clearly feeling the full band arrangement wasn't quite ready yet. The session only produced that single version of Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window. And even though having a finished song cut obviously means the session was a success, it was still difficult to come by. It began with 4 false starts as Dylan tried to explain the song to the band, boiling over at one point when he scornfully addressed Rick Danko on bass with, "If you don't know it, man, don't stay in front. You don't know the chords." He then strummed the chords on his guitar, showing Danko. Danko asked for another rundown, which Dylan gave him, but he stumbled on the next take again in the same spot. Dylan this time shouted, "Rick, you've got to remember. You've got to remember." Clearly, the atmosphere alone shows this wasn't going to be a successful session. But compared to other Blonde on Blonde sessions in New York, it was actually pretty productive. After this, Dylan would spend most of December in California performing a dozen concerts. He then downed tools following the birth of his son, Jesse. The third Blonde on Blonde session took place on the 21st of January back in the city. They dedicated the entirety of it to She's Your Lover Now. They did 17 takes. None made the album. There's more changes in this session too. The 4 members of the Hawks returned with guitarist Mike Bloomfield, but there was a new drummer, Sandy Kornikoff, a friend of the Hawks from Canada. Kornikoff was Gregg's replacement, a replacement for the replacement. But Kornikoff was well known to the Hawks. He'd replaced Helm on drums in the touring band, so this wasn't a huge shift for Dylan or the band. It was, though, his only Blonde on Blonde session. And it wasn't a good one. They spent 12 hours trying to get the song. 12 hours. They ran through the tune with various tempos that day. Dylan started out by playing guitar. He then tinkered with the arrangement as they cut the song. He then moved to the upright piano, trying to kickstart the song's creativity. But it still wasn't happening. By the 9th take, Dylan once again was getting frustrated. By the 11th, he'd voiced it to the band. A take had broken down and Dylan addressed his players with, "Something's wrong, it's not together, man. Play it together, just make it all together, nothing fancy." The band were apparently just as annoyed as Dylan. Bloomfield replied, "Hey man, it's not our fault, it's just different every time, you know." Clearly, they were struggling with Bob's pace, which is not unheard of for Dylan. After this discussion, Bob went back to the electric guitar, but still, it didn't help. Later in that session, around 2 a.m, Dylan broke. He came to a realisation. "I can't hear the song anymore," he told the band, and he dismissed them. The game had gone. In the wee small hours, he was sitting alone at the piano with Johnston in the control room. He started to play the opening chords of a song, Finding His Way, and then it clicked. 60 seconds in, he launched into a full 7.5 minute take. After 12 hours, it was the first complete take of the day. Huh, he said to himself. It was then he must have realised that something needed to change. It wasn't him. It was the band. Despite the song never making it onto the record, it was a major turning point in the recording of Blonde on Blonde. 4 days later, they were back in Columbia's Studio A, and there were more lineup changes. Finally, there was a breakthrough. After a couple of takes of Leopard Skin Pillbox Hats, they moved on to One of Us Must Know Sooner or Later. They ground out 24 takes and got it on the final one. The success wasn't to be repeated in New York, though. The final Blonde on Blonde session on the 27th yielded nothing. They attempted the song Lunatic Princess, and there was another 4 goes at Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat. They also attempted I'll Keep It With Mine another 3 times, but alas, nothing. In fact, it was so unproductive that 2 out of the 3 songs wouldn't even make it onto the album in any form, let alone the cut from this session, seeing the light of day. By this point, it was slim pickings. A lot of studio time and not much to show for it. In fact, only 1 LP song to show for it, and a single that I think everyone knew wasn't really Dylan's best and was just rushed out for commercial reasons. The main problem was the band. The incident with She's Your Lover Now seemed to represent the whole of the New York sessions. Years later, Dylan confided in critic Robert Shelton, saying, "Oh, I was really down at that point. It was the band, you see, but I didn't know that. I didn't want to think that." Dylan must have been at a low at this point. No album emerging and songs that were still really taking shape and weren't quite fully formed yet. So how do we get from this situation to one of the greatest albums ever made? Well, it involved a change of scenery. Dylan was off to Nashville and his life would change forever. That's something we look at next time.
Explain it to her, you're her lover now.
That is it for this episode. Next time, we go to Nashville and things really start to pick up for this record. The Nashville sessions are absolutely fascinating. That is my favourite episode I've written so far for this little series on Blonde. It was a fascinating recording process, really, for this record. So we get to that next time. In the meantime, as I mentioned at the start of the show, if you want to support the show, if you want to join a little community we've set up on the Patreon feed, the link is in this episode's description. I'll see you next week for episode 2. In the meantime, take care and stay safe.
A Fueled by Coffee production.